pick up our discussion where we left off yesterday on the influence of Judaism on the church, and I'm not going to say much about this. I'm going to go through this very quickly. It's not all that important to us. Many scholars anxious to discover sources for Christian ideas. They look to Gnosticism or Proto-Gnosticism, the mystery religions, the idea of, you know, the gospel. Is it from heaven or from men? Well, if those who hold that it's from men, they got to, you know, what we call the New Testament Christianity, the gospel, or the Christianity in general, Christian doctrine. If it did not come from heaven, where did it come from? Well, liberal scholars who assume it didn't come from heaven are always trying to find source. They look to the Dead Sea Scrolls. They look, as I say, the mystery religions. They look to philosophy. They look to everywhere they can look. And one of the places they look to is, of course, Judaism. And there's an element of truth in this. But just in outline form, what are the influences of Judaism on Christianity? Well, first of all, the canonical Old Testament always has been a part of our scripture. That's very simple, isn't it? By the canonical, I mean as opposed to the apocryphal Old Testament books. Secondly, there came into being a whole body of what is called Jewish apocalyptic literature, and I'll give you the years here, 200 B.C. to A.D. 100. An apocalyptic book is a book like the book of Revelation, visions, symbols, figurative language, and many Jewish apocalyptic books appeared patterned after the book of Daniel and Ezekiel. Later on, we're going to see that there were New Testament apocalyptical books or later apocalyptical books patterned to the book of Revelation. But you know, people like this, especially the people, you know, sort of like it allows a lot of speculation. Now, I list some of these: Enoch, Baruch, the Testament of the 12 Patriarchs, 4th Esdras. These are books, some of them, which were not were so far out that they didn't even get in the Apocrypha. And some of them were later than the Apocrypha, the Old Testament Apocrypha. And you know what that is from the Introduction to Biblical Studies class, right? But I mention these because some of these books become very important to the medieval church. They took them very seriously. As a matter of fact, for instance, the theory of British Israelism and Armstrong, the Worldwide Church of God, Armstrong's business, the primary source for that is the book of Esdras, 2nd Esdras, which came after the Christian era. Talked about lost Israel wandering over the earth somewhere, and where Israel, who's got Israel? Where are the lost tribes? Well, where'd that come from? Where'd that idea come from? It didn't come from the Bible. Certainly didn't come from history. Not lost in that sense. Well, it came from some of this apocalyptic literature. You got that? So this affected the church in a way. We don't appreciate this because we kind of gotten over that foolishness, but if you were a part of medieval Catholicism, these books, some of these books, not all of them, some of these books would be a part of your thinking, you know, a part of your reading, a part of your thought. For instance, some of the stories which make up medieval Catholicism, some of the saints even, come from this kind of literature. And so some of it was Jewish, and it affected the church. And I just put that in. That's a whole separate study, and you may just want to know that is an issue. These works are generally noted for their eschatological extravagance, fantasy, sometimes silliness. Move on to the institutions of Judaism. How did they affect the church? The architecture of the synagogue was a model for many early church buildings. The oldest church building, of course, is found in Dura, Europa, in Syria. In this area, the oldest church building, 3rd century church building, and this is where it's been found, and it roughly like the synagogue. However, don't get all excited about that, because the synagogue is a sort of fairly a basic structure. You could almost by accident duplicate the synagogue. It's just not very, you know, it's rectangular, and people got to sit somewhere, and the speaker's got to stand somewhere, and it's just pretty basic. Jewish sacerdotalism. You know what the word sacerdotal means? Having to do with priestcraft. Jewish sacerdotalism, having priests, mediators between God and man. These served as the prototype for the evolution of the priesthood in the Roman Catholic Church later on. In fact, they base it on that. So this Judaism affected the church in this way. Next, God perpetuated the basic institution of the eldership in the church. And the eldership was a sort of a synagogue thing. But again, you see, God ordained there be elders in the church. Well, there were men who served more or less as elders in the Jewish synagogue. We say, well, does that mean that, you know, Christianity borrowed from Judaism on that? Well, you see, that's a pretty basic fundamental arrangement. You got to have a leader. You got to have somebody who knows what he's talking about. Somebody's got to be in charge. And therefore, that is not really significant. That God, follow me, that God would ordain elders in the church, and that these men would have some similarity to that kind of office in Judaism, in intertestamental Judaism. Why? Well, you see, that's pretty simple arrangement. And by the way, synagogue worship, here we do find some borrowing, but not in matters of faith, not in content, but in practice. For instance, if you read through the New Eusebius, you often find that the man in charge of the worship service, so who's in charge of the worship service? Sometimes the man who's leading the worship service, you know, is called a president, translated president. Well, this came from the synagogue, where you had a man who was sort of, because of his abilities, he was not an apostle, had no particular authority, except that he was just sort of the man who ran things. Somebody, and again, it's very simple. This isn't in the Bible, but they did this. And by the way, the Bible doesn't say who conducts the worship service. Who gets up and leads the singing and says, now we're going to do this, and now we're going to do that. It's very free and open, and since the church was Jewish for the first 10 years of its existence, as we're going to point out in a few minutes, it's only natural that they would copy many of these practices. They were cultural, they were common sense. This is a long way, you see, from saying that the church got the idea of the content of the gospel. It's one thing for the church to borrow simple procedures from Judaism. And what would be, follow me, if they were been Jews all their life, they would know nothing else. So the fact that we find church buildings looking much like synagogues, and some elements of worship being like having elders, men in charge, having a president, that's a long way from saying that the theological content of the gospel depends upon Judaism. That's just going too far. And no serious scholar really says that. That's pretty of a kind of lunatic fringe among the liberals, and their lunatic fringe is very wide. Then we come to the diaspora. You know what the diaspora is? The Jews of the dispersion. And this affected the church even as it went out into the away from Judea and Jerusalem and Samaria. Harnack, if you continue your studies in this subject, well, you come across Harnack. I'm not going to get a bibliography of Harnack, but he estimates that of the 55 million people in the Roman Empire, 8 to 10% were Jewish, especially in the days of Jesus. 8 to 10% of the people in the Roman Empire were Jewish. One of the reasons was, especially in Rome, but one of the reasons why Jews would tend to gradually increase their population in the community was that the Jews were the only ones who raised all their children. I'll say more about that later. But you realize that they raised all their children. Others commonly did not. There are many other reasons. Do you realize in the days of Jesus there were more Jews living in the city of Alexandria than there were in the whole land of Palestine? We all think of, you know, Jesus went to the Jews. We didn't go to very many of the Jews. For instance, Jesus grew up in Galilee, right? Do you realize the Jews were a minority in Galilee? Jesus followed the practice of going only to the lost sheep of the house of Israel, as he told the Syrophoenician woman. That's why, for instance, we do not find Jesus even in the major cities. We find him in Bethsaida and Chorazin, Capernaum. Well, these were the little villages. Why didn't you go to Tiberias? And remember Jesus told the story about, I heard a sermon one time about concerning the prodigal son, that he was feeding the pigs. Of course, Jesus told the story in Galilee. He was feeding the pigs. And then you read about the Gadarene demoniac, and the demons went into the pigs, the swine, they ran down the hill. I heard a sermon one time where the guy said, well, what about the fellow lost all the pigs? See, and it's good enough for him. John R. Rice said this. It's good enough for him. He should have been, as a Jew, he should have been raising pigs anyway. That's very silly, because, follow me, the majority of the people in Galilee were Gentiles, not Jews. In fact, it was called Galilee of the Gentiles. And so there was a concentration of Jews in Judea, but the Jews in Judea were just a tiny fraction of all the Jews in the world. You got that? There were more Jews in the city of Alexandria, Egypt, that one city, than there were in the whole land. There were more Jews in the lands to the east, the lands of the Parthians, the old Mesopotamian Valley, than there were in Palestine. There were more Jews in the Mediterranean world than there were in Palestine. So when Jesus not only went to the Jews only, he just went to a small fraction of the Jews, which indicates his purpose culminated in his death and resurrection, not in the range of his preaching. That was for the church to do. See, his primary purpose was to die. Their primary purpose was to go into all the world. Does that bother you? Do you realize that? We often think of the Jews in Palestine, the sprinkling of Jews everywhere else. Well, just a very small fraction of the Jews that lived in Palestine in the first century. Why I went to Egypt? In other words, why, that'd be a logical place to go. Because, by the way, the question is, this is why Mary and Joseph fled to Egypt when Herod threatened the life of the child. The answer is probably yes. You see, the Jews had a special privilege in Egypt. The Jews were, they had more political power, more standing, and they probably went to Alexandria. I don't know where they went, but in Jesus' day, there were five, in Jesus' day, Alexander's divided into five sections, five cantons, they'd be called later on, and two of the five were Jewish. Two-fifths of the sections of the city, they may have had more than two-fifths of the people. And they were wealthy, and they had political power. Herod couldn't just waltz in and get them if he wanted to. If not, he wouldn't have tried. But did you realize that? Well, that's a lot of people don't. By the way, and the majority of the Jews in the first century world were more Greek than they were Jews in their culture. Their language was Greek, their thought was Greek. In fact, the latest scholarship among Jews is, and it's probably right, is that there was no form of Judaism, even in Palestine, which cannot be called Hellenistic Judaism. The Pharisees were even Hellenistic in many ways. It's truly a one-culture world, as we've said. Well, I have no more time for that, except to say that this is bound to have an effect on the church, and it did. There were many God-fearers. We read about them in the Bible, don't we? Gentiles who accepted the one God of the Old Testament without committing themselves to the Jewish way of life totally. Now, they mentioned Luke 7:1, Acts 10:22. You can read these later. These were quasi-proselytes who were prepared intellectually for the gospel. Timothy was one of these. Timothy was Jewish, and yet he had never been circumcised. And Paul had it done later to keep down criticism. Get that? Was he a Jew or not? Well, yes and no. See? So you have these, they're called God-fearers. So you had a lot of Jews who were ready for the gospel in that they were not all that attached to historic temple-centered Judaism. It's a thing of degrees. And you had a lot of people who appreciated Jewish monotheism, its high intellectual quality, but who did not follow all the rituals, did not follow all the dietary laws. They're called God-fearers in the New Testament. Well, these were a ready-made field of evangelism. Well, this affected the church, of course, affected the constituency of the church. Last of all, Jewish persecution. And this affected the church in another kind of way. Because, and you understand, when I say affected, I don't mean affected for the good necessarily, affected a good or bad. Because of the persecution, there was a great deal of antagonism and animosity toward the Jews and Judaism in the early church. You realize that Roman persecution is just barely beginning when the New Testament closes. One place you find Roman persecution really talked about is the book of Revelation. The persecution you read about in the book of Acts is Jewish persecution. See, Paul was when he wrote the prison epistles, you see, it's beginning. He's in prison in the Neronian persecution. But again, we're going to see in just a few minutes, or tomorrow, or Monday, that was not really the beginning of full-fledged Roman persecution. That was sort of a freak situation. So what you read about in the book of Acts is Roman persecution. Paul was accused by the Jews, and therefore he appealed to Caesar. Well, this created animosity between the Jewish community and the Christian community. And we're going to talk about this later, but by the time that the first century closed, there was a great cleavage. And it's interesting, just as early Jewish Christians often said that Gentile converts were not acceptable unless they observed certain requirements of the law. Remember the Acts 15, famous, the Jerusalem conference? What was the problem? Well, for 10 years, the church had been Jewish. And by the way, I deal with this in the Western Civ 1 in more in detail. I'll just mention it in passing here. But you see, for 10 years, the church had been Jewish, and they had become confused in their minds what were matters of faith and matters of opinion. See, when the Jews became Christians, they didn't become Gentiles. They didn't, you know, the day of Pentecost, they didn't come out of the baptistry saying, pass the bacon. they continued to observe all the dietary laws. Remember Peter and the housetop in Joppa? They continued to observe all the dietary laws. They continued to observe the Sabbath. Very interesting. Sabbatarians use this to say, aha, because it's still a binding holy day. Oh, no. There was no reason for them not to. They continued observing the Sabbath. Finally, they were rested on the Sabbath. The Sabbath, they continued to go to the synagogues until they were cast out. Paul himself did. They observed the dietary laws. They continued to practice circumcision. And so they'd done this for so long that they, in their minds, these things took on the force of matters of faith. But when the Gentiles began to come into the church, you see, that meant nothing to them. And the Jews were horrified. Why? Well, these people don't keep the Sabbath. They eat all that junk they shouldn't eat. They don't practice circumcision. They can't really be Christians. And so they had to sort that out, which were matters of faith, which were matters of opinion. So what was this announcement sent from Jerusalem? Well, the Gentiles, let them, you know, keep from idols, and from blood, and beyond that, forget it. You can't make anything binding. And by the way, the old Ebionites, or the Judaizers we talk about, reflecting the book of Galatians, for instance, who tried to make them go into the church through the synagogue, they were simply Christians who couldn't accept that. There were believers who said, no, it's absolutely impossible. If you're going to be acceptable to God, you've got to keep the Sabbath and the dietary laws and circumcision and these other things. They simply would not accept the decision of the apostles. Does that make sense to you? And by the way, of course, like the Seventh-day Adventists and the Armstrongites still around today, still saying the same thing. This is new Ebionism. Well, anyway, but it's interesting, within almost one lifetime, when the Gentile Christians came in, the Jewish Christians said, no, you've got to be more Jewish, and that would cause all kinds of problems. So later, Gentiles, because of this widening gap, the two main things that widened the gap, created the animosity that we read about early on between the Jewish community and the church, where some of the Jews were in the church, was first of all the Jewish persecution of the church. I've already talked about. Second, it was the fact that when Jerusalem fell in AD 70, the Jews set it out. Remember, Jesus had said, flee, get out when you see them. If you're on the housetop, don't go down and get your coat. When they see the armies coming, get out. And the Christians did. And the Jews never forgave them for that. The Jews never forgave the Jewish Christians for not helping defend the Jewish state. You abandon us. And that created famine. So the Christians tended to hate the Jews because the Jews persecuted the church. Then the Jews came to hate the Christian Jews because they did not participate in the defense of Jerusalem. There were other factors, but so this, by the way, this is the beginning of this animosity which became anti-Semitism in the Middle Ages. It all began there and developed and grew until you have modern anti-Semitism, until you have the Holocaust. But still, Luther was in favor of the Holocaust. Did you know that? Martin Luther said, we'll put all the Jews in the concentration camps or put them to death. He was, the idea of what Hitler did, it wasn't his idea. It was Martin Luther's idea. But he wasn't the first either. That was very common, you know, that way of thinking was common in the medieval world. But it all began back here, okay? Well, this had an effect on the church. You can see why it would have in many different ways. Did not spend that much time on that. But later on, let me finish what I was saying. Just as the Jewish Christians, said to the Gentiles, you've got to be more Jewish. Later on, the Gentile Christian went the other way. And they tried to force Jews to give up all vestiges of Judaism. See, the early Jews were wrong, saying to the Gentiles, when they came into the church, you must keep the Sabbath and the dietary laws and practice circumcision. So later, the Gentile Christians, equally wrong, said to the Jewish converts, you must give up Sabbath keeping, you must work on the Sabbath, you must change your dietary laws, you must quit practicing circumcision, which was also wrong. There were still matters of opinion. Y'all see that? And this, so you see the antagonism. And this is important. I wish we had more time to spend on it, but we don't. Any questions on that? See where we're going with that? It's quite a, these things really began very early.
Is that what Paul was dealing with in Romans there? The Jews, the Greeks going the other way?
No, he's still talking about the Jews who are making things binding on the Gentiles. It's still too early for that. We talk about the one day is, one day is the same as other days. He's talking about the Jews there who are saying these Gentiles really aren't of God. They're not spiritual because they have no regard for the Sabbath. So that's a little bit early for that. This came late after the close, towards the end of the first century.
We don't really have anything in Scripture.
No, early church history on the second, where the Gentiles turned it around, reversed the thing, and made the Jews give up these things.
It's one of the reasons why so few Jews came into the church later on. The church began to treat the Jews very badly, very early. By early, I mean by the end of the first century. Mainly because, well, these are all the reasons I've given. They just, and there were many other minor factors. That's a good question, though. Yeah, which one's which? Okay, let's leave the religious situation now and come to the moral situation. And what we're talking about is the world into which the gospel came, how things were. The moral situation. I've summarized the moral situation in two words, degeneration and aspiration. First, degeneration. And by the way, the first chapter of Romans made perfect sense to the readers of the first century. This terrible indictment of the human race, of the Gentiles. Romans 1. In fact, Romans 1, 2, and 3, you know. You get to reading Romans 1, 2, and 3, you have a pretty gloomy outlook, but a very realistic one, of the human race. I mean, man is an inveterate louse. Man is evil. Well, that's the way it was. I give examples, and I wish that we could just talk for hours about each one of these. Divorce was rampant. Moral laxity, just general lack of morals, nudity and promiscuousness. For instance, if you went to the spectacles in Rome to watch, well, you know what was going on in the spectacles during the late first century and, well, middle and late first century? People dying horrible, spectacular deaths by the hundreds down, you know, in the arena. People having sexual intercourse in the stands, just, you know, open, homosexual and heterosexual, just open. Terrible. Great moral laxity. The debasement of women. We'll talk about that. Slavery. It's always been around, but it was, we find Marcus Aurelius trying to pass some laws to mitigate the cruelty to slavery. There was the old institution was getting more morally debased. Exposure of babies and abortion. Remember I said this, mentioned this before, the Jews were the only ones who raised their children as a matter of course. Yeah, the more Orthodox Jews, there's no difference in exposure of babies and abortion. And abortion is where you surgically get rid of the child before it's born. Exposure, you know what exposure was? It was regular practice, especially girls. If they didn't want babies, they didn't want to raise them for any reason. And Augustus, for instance, really, he would grant special awards to Roman Augustus, who was ruling when Jesus was born. He gave special cash awards to people. To Roman noble families who would have kids, simply because the noble families were dying out because these women and men, they didn't want to be bothered with kids. They wanted to have, you know, they wanted to be free to run around like people do today, and they were just killing all their kids, and so are not having any. So Augustus created a tax structure and even gave just cash gifts to try to encourage the old Roman families to have more kids and to raise the ones they did have, because they were just not enough to go around. The families were dying out. This was a general practice in the first century. Abortion, interesting. America is becoming a showcase of classic paganism in many ways. This is moral paganism. Now, yes?
Exposure to just leaving the baby.
Yeah, well, I suppose what they would do is, if you didn't want a child, if it was deformed, or if it was just, you had too many, for whatever reason, because it was a girl, There was a set place outside of town where they would take the baby, just leave them. And regularly people would come and look them over, people who wanted children, farmers who needed kids to work the farm, or mothers who'd lost a baby and just wanted one, or for whatever reason anybody wanted a baby, they would come and look them over, and sometimes they would take them. Many men would take them, and they would pick up the girl babies, raise them as prostitutes, and have a whole stable of prostitutes. Follow me? They would just go pick up these girl babies and take them and raise them, like on a farm, you know. And then when they get old enough, 11 or 12 years old, they become prostitutes. That was their living. You invest a lot of money in them raising them, but then they got their money back. Sometimes if the children weren't too deformed, like boy babies are not too deformed, slavers would come pick them up and raise them, and if they thought they would be good workers, and sell them as slaves. So they didn't automatically die. Now, if they were too deformed, nobody wanted them, they would just let them die. By the way, this is one of the things the church became noted for. As soon as the church was established, the church went and got those babies. The church, one of the things the church was noted for from the very beginning was, it, follow me, just regularly, just had the regular committees, the exposure committee, I used to call the baby committee, would go out, follow me, get the kids and raise them so that they would, to save them from that kind of life. And the church immediately took a stand against abortion. and it must do it again today. The Roman Catholic position on abortion has always been the right position on abortion. Well, this was a part of the world. Then the Roman spectacles of the first century. This was the part, and I give you an example here in your syllabus of Suetonius on Nero. Now here's the guy who put Paul in prison, Nero. This is an example of what was going on in the this is almost too, this is almost pornographic. It's history. But here's what Suetonius wrote about Nero. Nero practiced every kind of obscenity, and at last invented a novel game. He would always have a crowd, you see. He was released from a den dressed in the skins of wild animals and attacked the private parts of men and women who stood bound to stakes. After working up sufficient excitement, by this means he was dispatched, shall we say, by his freedman, Doryphorus. Married him, just as he himself had married Sporus, and on the wedding night he imitated the screams and moans of a girl being deflowered. According to my informants, he was convinced that nobody could remain sexually chaste, but that most people conceal their secret vices. Hence, if anyone confessed to obscene practices, Nero forgave him all his other crimes. Unspeakably immoral. And Nero, in fact, Nero, if he found somebody who was really immoral, he would forgive him anything. He would put to death those who weren't immoral on some pretext. Terrible. In fact, Nero married a young boy. There was a joke around Rome, would that Nero's father had married such a wife. You know, terrible. You know, now think about this. It'd be like the President of the United States, you know, having a show and doing something like that. Just absolute perversion, filth. And this was common. You can think about the man, you know, and we'd like to talk about Caligula and Tiberius. I mean, when this was just a way of life. Terrible, terrible perversion. You know, it helps understand when Paul said to Timothy, an elder is to be the husband of one wife. I think I mentioned this. Did I mention this before? I think so. Husband of one wife. You're not talking about divorce. Divorce may be covered in the qualification with elders. Not covered there. Always simply saying, you find a man who sleeps with his own wife and nobody else. Why? Because of the idea that a man would sleep with one woman, you know, was just unheard of. It wasn't expected. In many cultures today, it's not expected. It's even in our country. I've had experience being in situations where, some of you may run into this in a job, where if you're married and you say to your friends, what you got going on the side? Nothing. I'm faithful to my wife. They don't believe you. I see men that actually, I know men, if you told them, it's so far removed from cultural expectation, they just can't imagine it. So you found immorality was accepted as a terrible world, morally. But on the other hand, as there always are, there were moral aspirations. And I'll just mention these very briefly. The Stoic ethics. Stoic ethics were very high, and this was a mitigating force. The Stoics tried to counteract this terrible immorality. Did you find where I am on the syllabus? Under aspiration, I just list aspiration. Okay, I didn't put this in. You can, the syllabus is next published, it'll be in there. Just listen. Okay, you have to write this in, do some writing. Stoic ethics were high. This was a mitigating force. Okay, you got that? Stoic ethics ran against this. Secondly, there was among individuals in the nobility, especially, there was uprightness. Many cried out for the old. For instance, Virgil did this. The poet Virgil and others said, "Let's go back to the old days, to the old virtues when Rome was great. Such virtues as fidelity and honesty and integrity." So there was, as there always is, a minority crying out for a return to morality and sobriety. And let's lead just to say that much of the world was ready for a new moral order, ready to listen to a good argument for the higher life. One of the reasons the church grew was because of its high moral standards. Listen, people get sick of that. Deep immorality does not create joy. The well runs dry. For instance, you go down south the Orange Blossom Trail, you do not find a colony of the world's happiest people. Follow me? You just start Orange Blossom and take the prostitutes and the pimps and the bartenders and all the hangers-on and that kind of world. What you find is people whose lives aren't working. Their marriages aren't working. One of the reasons they drink so much. fascinating. There's people who are who follow this kind of life, there's it does create a thirst for something better, and not with every, not universal, of course, not everybody. But a lot of people wanted something better, and the high ethics and morals gave good reasons for a better kind of life, a higher kind of life, and thousands accepted it, followed Christ. They said, enough of that. And in other words, this, when the gospel, when you got a man like Nero, you know, doing what he's doing, then the gospel, its intellectual respectability, its moral stature, is attractive, but not to everybody, but to many people. And it is today, by the way, isn't it? You know, people, like many people don't even give the many people will not even pay attention to the call of the gospel until their lives break down, quit working, their marriage fails, or, you know, they get a son or daughter into drug addiction, or they themselves get into drug addiction, or get into alcoholism. Then they begin to look for something better. So it's a human phenomenon. Okay, enough of that. So we have degradation, yet there was aspiration. And this was the world into which the gospel came. Now we begin our discussion on, we give it the discussion three. And by the way, I think you will not have to do a reading assignment for next Tuesday we meet next, because I think Monday, we meet Monday? Yeah, Tuesday we don't meet. I think we're not going to be able to, I think we'll probably spend this the rest of today and all of the next discussion time on discussion three. So I built this into the syllabus. We're not going to be behind, because some of these are heavy early on and we thin out later on. But anyway, we come now to the growth of the church. The growth of the church. And I had you read the sources. There's this addendum. The reason I had you read it early on is because this is in the back of the syllabus, so that when I make reference to some of these names, I do not have time. Time will not permit me to go back and give a biographical sketch of the sources, the apostolic fathers, for instance, Justin Martyr. And so you're reading, you've been introduced to him, and if you have any questions, you know, if you're not just who is he again, when I cite him in the lecture, you can go back to the back of the syllabus and remind yourself. I'm not going to test you on that. But I want you to, the information is there, so you can get a brief biographical sketch, who he was, when he lived, and what he wrote, okay? So I did that, so now I feel at liberty to use these names for these sources, knowing that you do have that information available to you in the syllabus itself. Did that because of time. The growth of the church. Well, there was the decline of what we call the Jewish church. Acts 21:20. That was the high water mark of Jewish Christianity, the statement that Jews were accepting the gospel wholesale. I've already talked about factors in the decline of the Jewish church, the Jewish persecution of the church, the loss of, I didn't mention this, the loss of leaders of the Jewish community of the church. You lose a man like Paul, it makes you mad. Then the destruction of the Jerusalem, this helped when Jerusalem was destroyed in AD 70, this was sort of the mother church, and this allowed Rome to become the center of Christian activity. Before Jerusalem fell, much of the center of activity was Antioch. Paul worked out of Antioch, not Jerusalem. And Antioch was the third city of the empire. By the way, the Roman Empire, the first city of the Roman Empire was Rome. The second city of the Roman Empire, as far as power, influence, population, wealth, was Alexandria, Egypt. And the third city was Antioch of Syria. So Paul, this was the third city of the empire, as they called it. Now, Jewish Christians, if I point out, set out the Jewish war, made the Jews mad. Christians were then excluded from the synagogues. We see this even in Paul's day, in the time period covering the book of Acts. By the way, I just mentioned the revolt. Jerusalem was destroyed in AD 70. In AD 132, 135, the final Jewish revolt under Bar Kokhba, the son of the star, the final Jewish zealot. After Bar Kokhba, it became illegal for Jews to live in Jerusalem, and that was sort of the last gasp of the Jewish state. The Jews sort of hung on and fought more, but after Bar Kokhba, whatever was left was cleaned up. And Jews that couldn't even live in Jerusalem again until until 1940s, when the establishment of the modern state of Israel. And they went in and were allowed to buy land, live there again. There was the rise of the Jewish sects. This caused the decline of what we call Jewish Christianity, culturally speaking, not doctrinally speaking. This is the Ebionites, and I've already talked about those. What other conclusions can we draw? All these and other factors led to the ever-widening gap between the Christian and the Jew. The church was growing while nationalistic Judaism was in decline. The Jewish-Christian movement drops from history. Justin Martyr speaks of people who were caught in the middle, accepted by neither, Jews nor Christians, although they were Jewish believers in Christ. What about the Jews? You wanted to become Christians, yet the church really didn't accept them. The church is a very bad blot on the church very early, saying you must become Gentile. See? Now, not to be baptized into Christ. You've got to change your whole lifestyle. And what about the people who wouldn't? Couldn't. Didn't, really shouldn't have been called upon to do that. Where were they? Well, Justin Martyr mentions these people, so left in the middle. That's very, very bad. Come now to the expansion of Gentile Christianity. Are you understanding what I'm saying? When I say Jewish Christianity versus Gentile, I'm not talking about a different set of doctrines. I'm talking about cultural expressions of Christianity. Gentile Christianity. Well, the growth accelerated in the second and third centuries. The greatest strength, by the way, was in Asia Minor. The strongest place in the stronghold of Christianity was this part of the world right in here. That's where the many New Testament books were written. The Book of Revelation was written there. The Book of Ephesus was written to there. Some of the pastoral epistles were written there. We're going to find that it was that part of the world, not Rome, which was the strong part of Christianity. It was when Rome was gone and forgotten, politically and religiously. Constantinople stood, and we're going to see that right in here. Ancient Byzantium Empire stood, and the Roman Empire fell. And don't worry about that now, but I'm simply saying that this was the strongest. Now, Turkey, this was where Christianity was the strongest, and was for several centuries. Still is, by the way. In fact, Christianity would be a lot stronger in that part of the world now. Historic Christianity, Eastern Orthodox Christianity, had not the Crusaders killed them. The Crusaders came across from Europe. These were European barbarians, our ancestors. And they thought anybody who didn't dress like they dressed was a Muslim Turk. Time and time again, all these people just wore the native dress, the robes, the Eastern robes, but they were Christians. And they traced their Christianity all the way back to the beginning. And they came out, and the Christian Crusaders, so-called Christian Crusaders, just slaughtered them. It's funny. You follow me? The Christian Crusaders slaughtered most of what was left of the... See, the Muslims never persecuted the church. It's really funny. These Christian communities that had lived in perfect peace and harmony with the Muslims for centuries, then the Christians from Europe, the Crusaders, came and wiped them out. They thought they were Turks. They never bothered to ask. We're going to have a whole series on the Crusades, but I'm saying this was... I'm trying to help us see in a very brief sketch is why it sort of died out, why it's not a strong Christian area now, as a historic Christianity such as Europe is. Well, we'll come back to that. Christianity was stronger in cities, urban areas, as opposed to rural. But the culture of the first century in the ancient world was an urban culture. If you found culture, it was in the cities. We don't find strength lying in the rural areas until we get Western feudalism. And we'll talk about that later as well. I keep saying we're going to talk about all this stuff. We really are. It's in the syllabus. You can look ahead. It was more vibrant among the middle classes. Christianity has always been this. Christianity has never done a very good job of reaching the down and out and the up and out. we leave the down and outers, even today, we leave the down and outers to the Salvation Army and the up and outers to the Episcopalians, and we go right down the middle. And there are a lot of reasons for that, some justifiable, some good reasons, some bad reasons. I'm not moralizing, I'm saying this is the way it was, and as you has often been. The numerical strength, we don't really know, estimates run from 5 to 50%. by the year 323, AD 323, the end of our period, the period of the old Catholic Church, the ancient Catholic Church, what percentage of the population were Christians? Wasn't who you ask. Now, if you see historians, follow me, if you read a consensus of historians, and the estimates run between 5% and 50%, the only thing you know is that nobody knows. You've learned that. And, of course, they didn't keep statistics the way the computers weren't as good as ours. In other words, we do not know. More important beyond its numbers, Christianity was important beyond its numbers because it was strongest in urban centers where the policies of the empire were determined. That's not who you win, but how many you win, but who you win as far as political influence is concerned. Christianity had won the heart of the empire, mainly because old paganism had broken down intellectually, broken down morally. Christianity was the best game in town. The empire was disintegrating politically, the church was organizing itself, which was sad in some ways, but the point is, we're going to see later, and again, I'm looking ahead, we're going to talk about this, when the barbarians finally came in and took Rome for about the fifth time, the only person in town not to meet him was the bishop of the church. Everybody else left town. It was the only order in society, it was the church. It's one of the reasons why the church became a political power. The point is that Christianity did win the heart of the empire. And when Constantine finally became emperor and Christianity was no longer outlawed, no longer illegal, thousands poured into it. And sure, there were the opportunists. We're going to talk later how the church becomes paganized because so many people really weren't converted. You see, when the church is illegal, when you put yourself under the death penalty by becoming a Christian, you get some pretty good conversions. You get the real thing. But when it becomes popular to be a Christian, what happens to the quality of conversion then? And there were many opportunities. And you get many people who'd be in between. Many people who were basically, the people that believed in the gospel were just afraid to become a Christian. You follow me? They were believers, but cowardly believers or immature believers. Now, we ain't getting all high and mighty and self-righteous over this. I wonder how many of us would be Christians today if we knew a pretty good chance it'd land us on death row. And we say, oh, I would. You know, we're like Peter. You know, the rest of them are going to leave you, Lord, but I'll be there. I think we ought to be very slow to speak. I think we'll be very slow to say what we would do in cases of persecution. And one of the things we're going to learn, for instance, is people say, oh, persecution is good for the church. That's the last thing. Anybody who says that never been persecuted. Persecution is very bad for the church. We're going to see how it split the church and deprived the church of its leadership. One of the reasons the Roman Catholic Church developed so quickly, comparatively speaking, in a few centuries, why false doctrine took root is because all the good teachers were killed. What would happen to the church today if all the real teachers, scholars in the church were wiped out and this was carried on for two or three generations? What would happen? What did happen? If I hear anybody leaving this class saying, oh, persecution is good for the church, it purifies the church, that's a stupid thing to say. And we ought never say what we would do under persecution. We don't know what we'd do. So, this is something we learned from history. Christianity spread, historians agree that never before or since has an idea spread so rapidly by persuasion. Ideas that the Muslim faith spread more rapidly than Christianity in the 7th century B.C. or A.D. But, how they spread it, you know, with the sword. They would line them up and say, in some cases, you know, would you like to be a Muslim or would you like to be dead? And since you put it that way, I can see your argument. Now, they didn't generally do that, but often did it. And the church, and this is, I want you to see this. This is a very important point. And it's a thrilling point. The church literally... by the time the Roman Empire woke up to the danger that the church was to the Roman Empire, it was too late. The church took the world, took it very quickly. And it's amazing on two points. Number one, it was by persuasion, not military force. And secondly, it was in the force of great opposition, organized opposition. And we're going to talk about this next. There was the opposition, this sort of furnishes the outline for our discussion coming up. There was the opposition of the state, the persecutions, the organized opposition. There was the opposition of the critics, intellectual opposition. Then there were rival religions, religious opposition. The church didn't have an easy time of it. First of all, we come to the struggle of the church with the state. Why was the church proscribed, officially, legally forbidden in so many areas? We see all religions had to be licensed. Other religions were persecuted. Besides, you know that? Rome persecuted other religions. They regularly persecuted the Jews. Excuse me, Apollos and Aquila and Priscilla were driven out of Rome and met Paul in Ephesus because they had been driven out of Rome, and Rome persecuted the Jews as they did. And various mystery religions where you get some particular emperors didn't like particular religions. They would drive them out and persecute them and put people to death and in prison. Christianity wasn't the only religion that was persecuted. However, Christianity was unique in that it, by its very nature, could never become a licensed religion, as we would call it. You see, all totalitarian states must control private religious thought, at least on the surface, at least to a degree. That's why Russia, why does Russia persecute the church? It has to. Why? Well, you see, for a collectivist totalitarian state to exist, the state must be absolute. And what are you going to do with people who say, no, the state is not absolute, the state is answerable to a higher power? What are you going to do? What are you going to do with the Democrats? And the, not mean the party, but the as a philosophical system. What are you going to do with the Democrats that say the state is answerable to the people? Get rid of the Democrats. You've got to have an absolute state, right? It's in the nature of the thing. Any question about it, they admit it. Everybody knows it. What are you going to do with the Christian who says, no, the state's answerable to God?